I'm going to talk about basically my favorite trip ever, bedding down in Masai Mara. I was not prepared for how large vultures are. And this elephant like charged us. This is where I got the, can you call it a tattoo? But basically we saw a cheetah on this day, which was like super rare and super cool. Though it did hunt and kill a gazelle in front of us and then eat it. And that was actually quite traumatizing. He knew that flat out in a straight line, the speed of a Jeep was never going to be any match for a rhino. Welcome to another episode of These Corners of the World Travel Podcast. I am your host, Kelly O'Brien. Today, I'm going to talk about basically my favorite trip ever. I've had a few amazing trips that I will get to, but one that really sticks in my mind is this month that I spent in Kenya and Tanzania. As part of researching this podcast and what I was going to talk about, I went back through old blog posts, which aren't currently up at the moment because my website, thesecornersoftheworld.com. I'm like redoing the whole thing. Should I say this or not? Well, I'm redoing it because it was hosted on Wix, which is an Israeli company, and I wanted to remove myself from that company and go to a different company. So that led to a rehaul of the entire website, which I don't currently have time for because of all the health issues. So the website's offline right now. But I do still have the blog posts from when I was in Kenya. And I thought instead of me going through these and like making little talking points or notes, I would actually just read you some of the better paragraphs, I guess. Better is probably the wrong word. Like, I think I would just pick and choose. I went through the first few of them there a few moments ago. And I thought, you know what? Let's just do it live. Let's just do it. Let's just do it on air. And I'll take you basically through my entire month in Kenya and Tanzania. Like I said, it was one of the best months I've ever had. I went alone. I had quit my job in journalism in Ireland a few months, I think, prior. And as part of that, I was like, bucket list stuff. What am I going to do? That's like almost like a once in a lifetime thing that I'm just going to go and do on my own. And I had done the Camino de Santiago first. Well, I'd gone around Ireland first, then I did the Camino, and this was basically really the next thing that I wanted to do because I love animals. You may hear me shouting at my cat because she's very, very active right now, but apart from shouting at my very noisy, annoying cat, I do love animals, and I've always loved zoos. Well, no, I haven't always loved zoos. From a young age, I loved zoos, but as I grew older, I realized, like, they're not the best facilities at all, even if they do take care of the animals well, which mostly they don't. Even if they do, like, there's still like wild animals in these cages that are far too small for them. You know, when you consider the amount of land a cheetah will cover every day, for example, or being able to hunt in the wild instead of just having meat like that's already dead, like thrown at them. And it's just, I just don't believe in it. I don't agree with it. I don't go to zoos anymore. I don't support them. Even if they say like, we're a sanctuary and stuff, because that's how they get you. Like they make you feel as if they are doing great things. Some of them are like, but most of them are not, especially if they offer wildlife encounters. That's how you can really tell actually, especially in the ones in Asia, if they're in any way, shape or form saying, come interact with this animal, swim with the dolphins, touch the lion, do any of these things in the presence of an animal, that's how you know, just stay away because they are not ethical whatsoever. And that tiger is definitely drugged up to its eyeballs and, you know, put on a chain for its entire life. Anyway, I wanted to do a safari because it's flipped, you know, it's we're in the cage. We're in the cage looking at the animals that are roaming wild. And that's how it should be, I think. And I'd never experienced that before, so I really wanted to go and do that. So I basically booked flights to Nairobi in Kenya. My cat is called Nairobi, and I called her after the city, not the Casa de Papel. What's that in English? Money heist. there's a character in Money Heist called Nairobi. I've never even seen that show, but everyone's like, oh, did you call your cat Nairobi after Money Heist? I was like, no, it's the city. So that'll show how much I really loved this trip that I called my cat Nairobi. In preparation, if you are going, like, you will need to go to the doctor and see what shots you need to get. And according to my own blog post, I needed Hep A, Hep B, and typhoid. Please tell me how to pronounce that. I have no clue. I also had pre-booked a safari, basically, with Eric at another word I can't pronounce. Uamans Safari. I will link it in the description because I don't know how to pronounce that word. And, you know, pack certain things like bug spray. I packed a mosquito net. I also packed this thing. It was like a little fan, and you load a little tablet into it and it kind of whirs during the night. And my cat's attacking my legs. And I put this on one night, and it's made by the same company that makes the mosquito net. And I woke up the next morning under my mosquito net, and there was like dead bugs on the mosquito net that had been killed basically by this fan. And I was starting to think, maybe I shouldn't be inhaling this in the nighttime. It's, well, make your own judgment on that. I stopped using it after a while because I was like, this can't be good. I mean, it worked, but like, I don't think for my health or possibly the ecosystem that I should have been maybe using that. Anyway, you know, you might need malaria tablets and stuff, so you got to check all that stuff before you go. I'll read you out this little snippet because I think this is quite a funny introduction to what life is like in East Africa. If you're watching this on YouTube and you see the camera shaking, my cat is kind of playing with the stand that the thing is on. Just bear with me. I don't want to disturb her because she'll get angry. I wrote, Nairobi. I'm going to have to stop and put her out.
Come on, go up here.
Okay, she can have another chance. Upon arrival, I began to question my decision, the decision to go to, I guess, Africa in general. I'm not sure what I meant by that. My phone didn't work. Every taxi driver at arrivals was trying to get me into their car, and the guy supposed to collect me wasn't there, which was to be expected, I guess, considering my flight had been delayed. Waiting, I began to think I was stranded. Here is where I learned something very important about Kenya and about East Africa in general. It is best demonstrated with a well-used phrase called pole pole, spelled like pole pole in English, but pronounced pole pole. It's Swahili. In the Swahili language, which is a beautiful language, it means slowly, slowly. It's less a translation, however, and more a way of life. Nothing happens particularly fast in Kenya. If someone says they will be with you at 1 p.m., they will probably not show up until 2 p.m. at the earliest. And they won't even apologize because this lateness is apparently normal and to be expected. As a native of Western Europe, this concept was alien to me. In the fast-paced, corporate, Google-driven world I've been accustomed to, we all want things done yesterday. Everything has to be ASAP, on the double, make it snappy. In Africa, this is turned on its head. It's jarring, to say the least. But once you understand pole pole, once you accept pole pole, your time in Africa will be easier. For the whole month I was there, I don't think anyone either left or arrived on time. Yep. Drivers were pole pole, store workers were pole pole, and even checking into accommodation was pole pole. I go into a little piece here about how, you know, the accommodation was late. Fine, whatever, boring. One instance of this is annoying. Two is even more annoying, but as it happens again and again, you get used to it. You accept it. Strangely, you begin to go pole pole yourself. You stop rushing, you stop worrying about being on time. By the end of my 4 weeks in Africa, I actually liked pole pole. It was a far more relaxing way to live. I'll probably write up a separate little post about Swahili words and phrases you should learn if traveling to East Africa, but for now, I'll just mention one other phrase, Hakuna Matata. Anyone who has seen The Lion King will be familiar with this phrase already. It translates as no worries. Incidentally, there are many Swahili words used in The Lion King. Pumba, Simba, Rafiki, etc. But that's supposed to run of the... Yeah, so Pumbaa is warthog, I think. So literally, it's like the exact translation. Simba means lion in Swahili. Rafiki actually means friend, which is not in the same, you know... What's the word? You know, you would think it would mean monkey because of what's been going on. You know, Pumbaa, warthog, Simba, lion. Rafiki, which is a monkey, or a baboon, rather. Rafiki means friend. I actually quite like that. Rafiki is a nice word. Yeah. Hakuna Matata goes hand in hand with Pole Pole. They are, you could say, two sides of the same coin. You go slowly, slowly, and you have no worries. I actually bought a little Swahili phrase book while I was there. I think it's packed now, but it's somewhere around here. It was very useful. And actually, everyone was like super, super appreciative of even saying a few words in Swahili, because usually people don't, you know, so many people in Kenya speak English. I guess I think it was a former colony of the British Empire. I'm not in any way up on the politics of what that was about, but pretty much everyone it speaks English in Kenya, and I think it's because of Britain back in the day. Same with Ireland. Thanks, Britain. The next blog post I have is called Bedding Down in Masai Mara. This was amazing. So basically, you know, a few days in Nairobi, and I stayed in this beautiful hotel, and I kind of went out a little bit in the city, but not too much. I was a bit afraid, you know. I wasn't super, super well traveled at that stage, and certainly not super, super well traveled alone. And I was alone, and it was my first time traveling to, I guess, south of the equator, I think. Yeah, it was actually. And I guess the next blog post is talking about the start of the safari. And I was picked up late, as per usual, Pole Pole. And the first stop was the Great Rift Valley. I have a map behind me. So the Great Rift Valley, I don't know if you can see this. It starts in Lebanon and it goes all the way down to like Mozambique, I think. And it is like this massive canyon, well, valley. It's literally called the Great Rift Valley, and it's just the most beautiful place. And where we stopped to see one of the viewpoints of the valley was actually directly on the equator, where the equator meets it. And honestly, it was the best start to the entire safari that I could have hoped for, because it was just awe-inspiring. It was huge. Like, the only thing I can think to compare it to was, you know, later on I went to America and I visited the Grand Canyon. It's very different. The Grand Canyon is very sparse. It's largely, you know, brown and that kind of landscape, whereas the Great Rift Valley was like lush, green. But in terms of awe-inspiring, it's the only thing I can really compare it to. They're both like a similar level of like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm going to read you a little bit more from another blog post, the second one, and it's about the animal encounters of actually the very first day. So we took off in a jeep from Nairobi, and we went to the Great Rift Valley, stopped, you know, lookout, and then we get to the Masai Mara Game Reserve. The Maasai are a tribe of people in Kenya. I'll get to that in a bit. But basically, we entered the game reserve, and from then you pop up. The jeep kind of has a roof that you pop up, and you can like stand up and look out, and if there's animals, you can see them, and the guide will probably stop. And if you have binoculars or like a long lens camera, you can take some photos and have a look at the wildlife through the binoculars, that kind of thing. Here we go. It was mere minutes. Yeah, and I'm not exaggerating. It was like as soon as we entered the reserve, it was like, boom, animals. It was mere minutes before we spotted our first wild animal, a herd of majestic antelope. grazing peacefully on the side of the road. Next came the zebras, bounding along, skittish. Giraffes could be seen on the horizon before long, gracefully pacing between the somewhat isolated African trees. As the landscape rolled by, we began to see more wildebeest, the nervous, antelope-like creatures, tending to break ranks suddenly if we came too close, running scared from the cranking and revving of our trusty jeep. Amazingly, even though it was the first day of my 2-week-long safari, I think that's a typo, I think it was 3 weeks long, anyway, whatever, it was well into the evening, we even came across a herd of elephants thudding and trumpeting along the plains. The herd included baby elephants, though the adults kept them well guarded. You could only catch glimpses of them between the mammoth legs and trunks as they playfully ran from one adult to another. Our initial thirst for wildlife spotting satiated, our guide made note of the setting sun and began to make his way towards camp. Nature, it seems, has other plans. Once in the nature reserves in Africa, the driver guides will switch on their CB radios. At first, I wasn't sure why, but I came to learn that this communication with other driver guides in the park was useful for two things. One, warning about poachers, and two, tips about where the rarest of the animals were hiding. On this particular day, even though we were headed for camp, the driver received a muffled tip from the radio that only he could hear. Without a word to his, and I mean only he could hear, like, we could hear it, but we couldn't understand it. It was like, and the guide was like, oh, yeah, you know, immediately, like, I was like, how are you even interpreting what that was? It was in English, but it was just, I mean, these guides are amazing. They have, like, eagle eyes, and I don't know how they're hearing what people are saying in these muffled CB radios, but anyway, back to the blog post. Without a word to his passengers, our driver veered off his course and trundled through the bush once more. We were intrigued. Wow, I'm really being very flowery with my language here. A short time later, we spotted a group of 2 or 3 other jeeps stopped on the side of the road. The occupants were all standing in the jeep, making use of the raised roof, like I mentioned earlier, staring in the same direction, quiet, apart from a few shutter clicks from their fancy cameras. We pulled up and shut off the engine, and then I saw her. Beyond the nearest bushes, still and calm and entirely ignoring us, sat a beautiful, golden, muscle-laden lioness. Facing away from the commotion she was unwittingly causing, our lioness sat and remained still for what seemed like the longest time. Eventually she turned, looked over her shoulder, yawned a big cat-like gaping yawn, got up and started walking away from us, calm as you like. To her, a scenario like this was probably old hat. Another day, another bunch of humans coming to have a gawk. But to me, the experience was like nothing I'd ever experienced before in my entire life. One might argue that I shouldn't have been so moved, considering every Tom, Dick and Harry under the sun has had a look at a lion in a zoo somewhere. But this was completely different. It was like all the roles were reversed. I was in the cage and it was the lioness who was roaming free, going where she liked, doing what she wanted. There was no doubt in my mind about who ruled that land. And you know what? It felt right. It felt like that was the way it was supposed to be. I could go and look at the lioness if she allowed me to, but under no circumstances could I control her. Oh, that's actually really nice. I really like that. It was a relatively quiet trek to the camp after that. I think everyone was a little bit awestruck. We saw a hyena soon after that, pretty close to the camp, actually. And we also got to see 2 male Thompson gazelles locking horns over and over again in a fight over a female. But everyone knew the main event had been the lioness and that she was still out there somewhere, roaming wherever her heart desired. Oh, and then I'm talking about the camp, actually, which is kind of interesting. Basically, we arrived at the camp then and I had basically prepared myself for horrendous, like teeny tiny tents, no electricity, nothing. But it was pretty big. I'm going to share some photo magic here on this screen. I have some photos of the tent and there was like 20 of them. Each one actually had their own bathroom. Well, like a toilet behind a cover in the back. But it was something like you didn't have to go to an outhouse like some of the other game reserves. And there was a community building, like a brick building where the kitchen was. And there was electricity from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. and also from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. basically when they were making meals. And during the day, you would be out with a packed lunch in the game reserve looking at animals. And yeah. Oh, this is quite nice. Starving after what turned out to be a long day, I filled up on rice that night at dinner before making my way out to the bonfire, being stoked by some serene members of the nearest Maasai tribe. Clothed in their beautiful multicolored sheets, wrapped sheets, is sheets the right word? Maybe not, but clothed in their beautiful multicolored sheets, wrapped delicately around their tall, thin frames, the Maasai sat silently gazing into the flames. Black as night, one would never even see them sitting there, in the dark shadows cast by the fire, if not for the traditional African garb. Is that racist? Should I be describing someone as black as night? I guess it's fine. It's just a, you know, description of, an accurate description. I approached, said nothing, and sat with them, contemplating Africa and the wilderness and its immense beauty. Yeah, I remember that night, actually. It was very beautiful. I didn't even speak to the guy, and the guy didn't even speak to me or look at me or anything. And he had, like, this big long stick that was, like, way longer than he was even tall, even though he was very tall. And it was almost like tartan colors. If you've ever seen like the Scottish kilts and stuff, but like a thinner, very thin material and like kind of draped around the entire body. And he had this big massive stick and he was just like staring into the fire. And it was actually a really peaceful moment. I just went and we sat for a while and yeah, it was cool. Okay, well, basically the next day I'm talking about how I got a burn tattoo. I don't know if I'll bother reading this out. Let me just quickly scan it. Yeah, I went on a game drive. I saw zebras, giraffe. The guys were talking on CB radio again. Oh, we saw lion cubs that day. That was super cool. Three tiny lion cubs jumping and playing and rolling around the grass with each other. Amazingly, they didn't even look up when we approached. They just continued their game of crouching and wiggling and pouncing, just like any domestic kitty would. Any kitty that weighed 20 pounds and had razors for claws. I was feeling humorous the day that I wrote this, I guess. But if there's anything I've learned from National Geographic, it's that baby animals, especially ones as healthy looking and as carefree as these, are never far from their watchful parents. I peered into the bushes on either side of the cubs, leaning out as far as I dared. Sure enough, not 5 meters from where we were parked, a golden hue could be seen between the leaves and, every so often, the flick of what could have been a tail. Mentioning it to our driver guide, we inched the jeep a few inches to the right and caught a better sight. A golden-haired lioness lay in the bushes between the jeep and the cubs, facing her litter and licking her paws nonchalantly. How camouflaged she was both impressed me and scared me. It was to be a day of special sightings, apparently. Oh, sounds like something else is happening this day. Let's see. The next amazing sight. Oh, it's quite macabre, actually. The next amazing sight came in the form of huge vultures, multiple, tearing apart a carcass we came across. It was probably a wildebeest or a gazelle, but it was hard to make it out. It was probably, you know, probably bones by that stage. Within minutes, the birds had reduced the carcass to nothing more than a skeleton. The speed with which they did it and the ferocity with which they fought with each other for dominance was terrifying. Yeah, I remember that, actually. That was terrifying. I didn't like that. Vultures are huge. They are so big. They could definitely, you know, take off a child, basically. Like, they could 100% lift and take a child. I was not prepared for how large vultures are. And they are scary. Our next big game sighting came in the form of more lionesses sunning themselves in the midday heat. Since they weren't doing too much, we moved on. Oh yeah, okay. So day two, we're already bored of lionesses. We moved on, barreling towards lunch at the hippo pool. Barreling, unfortunately, somewhat too close to a male elephant walking in the same direction as us. Oh man, I remember this. This was terrifying. Yeah, there was a... I won't bother reading it. There was a male elephant on his own. At the time, you know, I didn't really know too much about stuff, but I mean, when a male elephant is on his own, you're kind of like, whoa, you know, you're wary because there's a reason. There might be, they might be very aggressive. And sure enough, it was aggressive. We were in our Jeep and we were coming along behind it. I guess we weren't really, I don't know what was going on with the driver guide, because they are usually very, very up on these kind of things and very knowledgeable. I'll tell you a story later about one of my favorite guides, Cyrus, and his mad stories about stuff. But basically, we came too close, too fast to this elephant, and he kind of like stopped and like turned around really quickly. And that was when our driver guide was like, oh, you know, shit. And he kind of like swerved and like went really much faster than he had been going. And this elephant like charged us, basically. I was like, oh my gosh, like we are dead. And I mean, we got away. It was okay. But, you know, it was kind of scary for a few minutes. It was very much scary kind of experience. Everyone was a bit like, oof, rattled after that. But yeah, let's continue. At the hippo pool, we stopped for a packed lunch. Yeah. Watching the big beasts blub around in the muddy water before spotting buffaloes and crocodiles on the way back to camp. This is really making me want to write more. Like, I miss writing. I'm a tech writer at the moment, not a journalist anymore. Though I do write the odd thing for a newspaper back home. But I really miss, like, this kind of creative writing. I should go back to it. Then I'm talking about going into the Maasai village. Oh, and this is where I got the... Can you call it a tattoo? I'm not going to call it a tattoo, because that kind of gives... And honestly, this is years ago, and now I don't think you can even see it anymore. But basically, yeah, that's... I'm actually going into quite detail here, so I might read this out. At the entrance to the village, I was met by a group of around 15 men, ranging in age from teenager to elderly. I was introduced to the chief's son, who was to be my guide for the evening, a great honor. The son of the chief, one of the few who spoke English, introduced me to his tribesmen, all tall with their beautiful ebony skin and all clothes in traditional garb, some in red robes called shuka, and others in multicolored sheets wrapped deftly around their torsos. Now that introductions had been made, the men came together to show me a traditional warrior dance. It was mesmerizing. Then they started their jumping dance. Oh yeah, that was cool. The traditional Maasai Adamu? Adamu? Apologies for butchering that. For the Maasai, the Adumu is just one in a series of rituals that make up the Unoto? I don't remember writing this, but I did my homework, apparently. The ceremony in which the junior warriors, or Morani, graduate to the ranks of manhood. Their bodies should stay a narrow pose, and their feet should not touch the ground. The higher the jump is, the stronger the guy is, and by all means, more respect, admiration, and desire he gets from women. Oh, okay. So obviously, Maasai jumping dance is also a competitive dance. After the dancing and chanting came to a conclusion, I was invited in beyond the walls of the village. Since the Maasai lead a semi-nomadic life, their houses are loosely constructed and semi-permanent. They are usually small, circular houses built by the women using mud, grass, wood, and cow dung. On the subject of cows, I should mention that the Maasai tribe has a deep, almost sacred relationship with cattle. They are guided by a strong belief that God created cattle especially for them, and that they are the sole custodians of all the cattle on earth. Oh. This bond has led them into a nomadic way of life, following the patterns of rainfall over vast land in search of food and water for their large herds of cattle. Therefore, it is not surprising to hear that the Maasai measure wealth by the number of cattle and children one has. All of the Maasai's needs for food are met by their cattle. In fact, they eat the meat, drink the milk, and on occasion drink the blood. Wow, okay. Bulls, oxen, and lambs are slaughtered for meat on special occasions and for ceremonies. The byproducts of the animals, skin and hides, are used as bedding, while cow dung is used for building. It is smeared on the walls. The Maasai's entire way of life truly revolves around their cattle. Having said all this, you'd be forgiven for thinking the Maasai were timid cow farmers, but you'd be wrong. Lions, and the hunting of lions, is just as much a part of their culture as cows are. The Maasai take lion hunting very seriously, and when I say hunting, I mean it in the biblical sense. One man, one spear, one lion. Guns are a no-no. Lions are never hunted for fun, and it's not uncommon for this extremely dangerous practice to result in the hunters themselves being injured or killed. When a hunter is killed, usually his body is simply left for nature to take its course. The Maasai don't tend to bury their dead, you see, as burials are believed to harm the soil. The practice is reserved only for some chiefs. Now I really, really did my homework for this blog post. I'm super impressed with my past self. Going on a solo hunt for a male lion, they don't hunt female lions. Oh, I wonder why. Do I go into that? We'll see. Going on a solo hunt for a male lion is seen by the tribe as a display of great courage and strength. But in recent years, the lion population has dwindled due to disease, and so the Maasai created a new rule that means they can now only hunt in groups, allowing the lion population to recover. Oh, okay, so instead of one person, one lion, one group, one lion. Makes sense. How very sustainable. I mean, obviously, I would rather the lion not be hunted and killed, but I mean, who am I to erode hundreds, if not thousands, of years of cultural beliefs? I learned all this and more in the Maasai village. I also got to see dances, chanting, bead making, and learn a few words of Ma and a few more words of Swahili. It was also where I got what I like to call my seventh tattoo. You know, I don't call it my seventh tattoo at the moment. It's not even my sixth because I got one laser removed. The Maasai make fire in a very traditional way. They carve a groove in a piece of wood, which they use as a base. They then place dry straw as kindling on the groove, and then they place the tip of a very long vertical stick on the base. They rub the stick between their hands as fast as they can, and after a few moments, the kindling catches fire from the friction. They then give each other decorative burn marks, in much the same way, minus the kindling. On their skin, the burn marks turn a lighter color. Oh, because of their darker skin, the burns stand out more than a black ink would. Interesting. In this way, they create intricate designs all over their bodies. Intrigued, I asked if I could have one. Of course I did. How young and stupid was I? At first, I think they thought I was joking. But then they started to get the materials ready. Time was an issue, so I was only able to get a small circular mark burned into my upper right arm, but at least it was something. Something to mark my time with the Maasai people. A time that, in hindsight, was all too short. Oh, I mean, it's gone now. I can't see it anymore. But it was there for a few years. And it was just a tiny little, you know, they did the fire thing, they did the stick thing, and rub, 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 rub. Ends really hot, stick it in my arm, done. Like, that was literally the extent of it. I don't think I can call it my seventh tattoo in any way, shape, or form. Okay, moving on. I'm going to try and speed this up now because I do not want this to be a million hours long. It's already 42 minutes. The next blog post I wrote about my time on safari in Kenya and Tanzania. I mean, we haven't even gotten to Tanzania yet. Wow, I wrote a lot. But, I mean, this one is actually quite interesting as well. I've titled it My African Safari, Day 4, brackets, Escaping Death by Lion. This, I think it was day 4 of the safari. And I'm not going to read out the whole thing because this one is quite long. But basically, we saw a cheetah on this day, which was like super rare and super cool. Though it did hunt and kill a gazelle in front of us and then eat it. And that was actually quite traumatizing. But it was a very interesting experience. And cheetahs are very beautiful, very dangerous animals. The other thing that happened on this day was someone in the... So basically, I had a 2 to 3 week long safari in the middle of my trip to Kenya and Tanzania. And this wasn't, I guess, the norm. It wasn't very typical. So I booked through this safari company and I wanted a group tour, but there was no one else who wanted that long a safari and that exact itinerary. So what happened was I ended up migrating between different groups and it was very ad hoc, very pole-pole. Everything was quite late. And I would, you know, be with a group of people for 3 days, and then I would switch to a different group for a day, then I would switch to a completely different group for like 4 days, and normally, usually people were great, and then this one time I got a van of all French people, and they all spoke English, and also French, but they didn't speak English for me. They just all spoke French. And then the driver, he spoke French. So I was completely lost for a few days, but then I moved on to a different group, so it was fine. But basically in this Jeep at this one point, someone had to go to the bathroom. We're out in the wilderness. There is no bathroom. So the driver guide, like stopped behind, I mean, I can't even say behind. He stopped near a small bush and he had some toilet paper and he said, here you go, do whatever you want. And while this person was going to the bathroom in the, you know, al fresco bathroom, we were kind of like milling around, you know, walking around. The guide had a gun, but he left it on the roof, or not on the roof, on the hood of the Jeep. And he went to go to the bathroom and, you know, kind of disappeared for a little bit. And we were just kind of like milling around, not really any rush, just, you know, just waiting. And, you know, the person comes back, oh, where's the driver, oh, wherever, I don't know. And then the driver comes back, and we're all kind of still milling around. Eventually, we get into the Jeep again, we pull off, and we drive around this kind of like, what's the word, is it copse? Like, this group of trees, and it was only maybe, I'm really bad at like determining distances, but like a few hundred meters, I guess, there's this group of trees, and we go around the group of trees. Basically, this is wilderness, by the way. There's no road, there's no nothing. There's some tracks, some places, but mostly it's just, you know, wilderness with some trees here and there. We go around this block of trees and there is a massive male lion on his own, like calming around. Basically, would have been on top of us if we had just waited around for another, like, maybe 5-10 minutes or something. And I was just like, oh my God, if we had waited any longer, like, that lion could absolutely have like eaten one of us. Maybe that's being a bit sensational, but I was shocked because the guide, you know, I thought that, you know, he wouldn't stop if it wasn't like a place he knew was safe, or at the very least he would like be vigilant, or like would have his gun, you know. I mean, obviously I don't want them to kill the animals, but like they would shoot up into the air, I presume. But yeah, it was just, it seemed so lackadaisical, and then like 10 minutes later there's a massive predator. So that was a bit jarring. And yeah, that really kind of made me sit up and take notice a bit more of my own safety, and notice that like I'm responsible as well for my own safety when I'm abroad, and when I'm in a dangerous, potentially dangerous situation, I need to be on it and not entrust someone else to be on it. And that has served me well, I think, for many years now. But that was kind of the first time I really got that lesson. Moving on swiftly to the following day, we saw white rhinos, which was super cool. I saw one black rhino later on in the trip, and it was from a very large distance because they're so endangered, but it was through binoculars. It was in the national park that's actually in Nairobi, and it was really cool. But white rhinos, we got like right up and close to them, actually, and it was in a place called Lake Nakuru, which had loads of flamingos, actually, just looking at the photos that I took. It was super cool. But that the lake waters had receded. Yes, I remember this now. We were quite far from the flamingos. There was a lot of them, but apparently there used to be even more. But the lake waters had receded in recent years, which is very, very sad. I am just going to read out some stuff because I haven't gone through this before. But while their flamingos were stunning to look at, they weren't actually the highlight of this park for me. That honor was reserved to the white rhino. Yes, of course. The first white rhinos I had ever seen in the wild, and one of only two times I would see them on this safari. I would subsequently see white rhinos again, I think, in Uganda. But yeah, on this time it was just twice. I'll talk about Uganda separately because that has a whole host of different cool different things, like the shoebill and the gorillas that I saw there. So that's a separate one. But also I didn't want to really actually promote Uganda at the moment because two tourists were actually recently killed there just 2 months ago. And I was going to talk about Uganda and I realized maybe I should wait a little bit on that to see how things play out in Uganda at the moment. But I had a great time when I was there. Back to Kenya. They were absolutely huge creatures, milling around, not exactly right beside the water's edge, but not too far from it either. Cautious, our driver guy didn't bring us as close as he did to other animals. You could sense he was a little wary of them. Even though they seemed relatively placid, there was no doubt in my mind that one of them could easily crush the sides of the Jeep and turn us over if they wanted to. Oh yeah, a few days later, I befriended a different guide and I asked him what kind of dangerous situations he had encountered as part of his job. He told me, this was Cyrus, he was so cool. He was like my best friend. I'm still friends with him on Facebook. If you're watching this, Cyrus, I miss you. He told me that one time he had a group in a Jeep and they were driving fast through a dry and dusty area. The vehicle was kicking up so much dust that he didn't realize that there was a white rhino directly ahead on the trail. He saw the rhino relatively late in the game, by which time the rhino had already started to charge the Jeep. In the rhino's defense, all it knew was that a large creature, roughly the same color as himself, was coming directly at him at speed. The poor creature, clearly thinking he was being attacked, felt he had no other option but to charge and defend himself. My friend, who I'm not naming in this blog post for some reason, but it was Cyrus. My friend said he swerved the Jeep to the side as soon as he realized what was happening and nearly overturned the car. Thankfully, although I wrote car, but I'm sure it was a Jeep. Thankfully, it came back to all four wheels, but by this time the rhino had turned and was charging again. My friend said he floored the gas pedal to get away and proceeded to drive the car in a zigzag motion. He knew that flat out in a straight line, the speed of a Jeep was never going to be any match for a rhino. But since the big beasts don't have great sudden turning ability, he thought he would get away with it if he zigzagged, and he was dead right. Nothing like that happened to us, however, and we were content watching the rhinos from a safe distance. Other species we spotted that day included Cape buffalo, another dangerous, super dangerous, and relatively more aggressive animal, water buck and large baboons. Yeah, I was shocked. Like, buffalo are incredibly dangerous, actually, and very, very, very aggressive. It's become a running joke with my boyfriend that I tell him about all these dangerous animals because some he doesn't believe are dangerous, but like hippos are incredibly dangerous, and also moose. Moose are so big, like oh my God, how big is a moose? It's insane. And they're so aggressive. And for some reason, I don't know if he doesn't believe me or it's just become a running joke that they're very dangerous animals. I've been joking that you'll get into your car one day and there'll be a moose in the back seat with a garrote trying to strangle you. Obviously that's a joke, but they are very aggressive and dangerous and they will kill you if they can. Of course, interestingly, I got to walk around outside the vehicle thanks to the presence of heavily armed game wardens who kept watch for predators. Of course, the guns were necessary in case of animal attack, but through talking to the guards, I learned they are mostly only ever used for defense against the heavily armed and ruthless poachers who still break into game reserves in Africa to kill animals such as rhinos and elephants and sell their body parts on the black market. Yeah. That evening, we left Lake Nakuru. The rest of my group departed for Nairobi, while I was bound for the ominously named Hell's Gate National Park. Oh yeah, I remember this. This was cool. So Eric, who owns the safari company, was like, hey, I have a day off. Like, do you want to like skip this one day of your safari and come with me on a bike ride? And I was like, yeah, okay, sure. So I think it was because I was between groups, maybe. There was no other group at this point to, you know, shoehorn me into. And the current group had left. I think that might have been the French-speaking group. And Eric was like, let's go cycling. I was like, okay, cool. So, yeah, we did. And I don't think we didn't come across anything crazy. So there's not really too much to say about that. But we went to Hell's Gate National Park, just me and him. And he's a super nice guy. He told me all about his life. We just cycled and no weapons, nothing. But I think that part didn't have many dangerous animals. It was largely just zebra that we saw. And I will read this bit, actually. We cycled in comfortable silence a lot, and other times we talked. He told me about his life and his family and about growing up in Kenya. He described how he was clearing foliage near his house one time and was bitten by a poisonous snake. a black mamba. He was rushed to the hospital and very nearly died. Thankfully, he survived. Yeah. And then we went to a ravine and we basically just had a very nice time. Yeah, then he went back to Nairobi and I continued to Amboseli National Park, which is in the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro. And that's where I met Cyrus, actually. Cyrus, who told me the story earlier about the rhino encounter where he had to zigzag. Super cool guy. Actually, like, I met so many cool people in Kenya and Tanzania, actually. It was really cool. And that night, I stayed in a lodge. That was amazing. It was like this. So I'd been staying in, as I described earlier, like this tent, which was in a compound where there was a main building where there was a kitchen and there was electricity for like 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening or something, where you could charge your phone or go and eat a meal that they cooked. But this night, for some reason, I pretty much had this place to myself. I was in like a log cabin on this amazing luxury resort with its own swimming pool. It was insanely luxurious in the shadow of Mount Kilimanjaro. Like, it was amazing. I'm share some photos because I have some photos actually of this that I have in the blog post. I'll try and extract them. I woke up in my very own log cabin on the edge of Amboseli National Park to the sound of faraway trumpeting from a passing herd of elephants. How cool is that? I miss that. I need to go back to safari. They were taking part in their morning trek, as I would later find out, from their home to the nearby swamplands for a day of playing and cooling down in the muddy water. For once, I didn't have to be up at the crack of dawn. Yeah, every day it was like 6 a.m. starts. It was, I mean, animals are most active in the morning and in the evening, so it makes sense, but I'm not a morning person. I was dying. I was like, oh my God, why do I have to get up so early?
Hi guys, I am just cutting in here because I'm going to end this episode and make it a two-parter. I got way too into this episode and it ended up being about an hour and a half long, which is too long. So I'm going to end it here and that will be the first part all about Kenya. And do check out the next video, which will be all about Tanzania. I'm just basically splitting the two in half so that no one has to sit through an hour and a half straight of me talking. I'm so glad that you watched to here, and please do subscribe to the channel if you really like it. Do watch the next video, and if you have any comments, leave them below and I will do my best to answer them. Thanks, bye.